Hello, and welcome to this third podcast brought to you by the Vatican Observatory Foundation. I'm your host, Bob Tremblay. Joining us today is artist, astronaut, and earthling, Nicole Stott, and her husband, Chris Stott. Chris is an award-winning entrepreneur in the space and satellite industry and a documentary filmmaker. Also joining us will be Brother Guy Consolmagno, director of the Vatican Observatory and president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation. I'll let our guests tell you a bit about themselves, starting with Nicole.
Thanks, Bob. Really nice to be here. Nicole Stott, artist, retired NASA astronaut a couple times in space, primarily on the International Space Station. Very blessed to have had that experience. Generally an earthling and very, very happy to be here with you guys, especially with Brother Guy, the special guy, Brother Guy, who Chris and I are very fortunate to call friend and to have met many years ago in Houston.
And I'll jump in there because there is a story. This is Brother Guy Consolmagno, and I'm originally from Detroit and been around lots of places, but as a Jesuit brother wound up being appointed to the Vatican Observatory nearly 30 years ago. And I think it was about 25 years ago that I got an email saying, would I be interested in doing a Bible study? And I'm thinking, you know, Catholics don't do Bible studies.
Yeah.
And a Bible study in Houston. I'm going, oh my God, definitely not in, you know, Texas Bible study. Bible study in Texas with astronauts. And I'm going, ooh, I could do that. Well, it was being hosted by Nicole Stott. And I think half of us there actually were Catholics. The other half were astronauts. I was not in that part of the group. And it was a fascinating experience, in part because of one of the astronauts who was there who was very upfront. He said, look, I'm not a Catholic, and I don't believe in these crazy things you Catholics do of, you know, because I believe that the Bible is literally true. And I'm thinking, have you read the Bible? You know, in Genesis, where it says there's a dome and water above the dome, you know, how come you don't get wet when you go into space? But talking to him, I understood better where people who are evangelicals of that particular variety come from. I got to respect him a lot more. Don't agree with his theology, but that's okay. He doesn't agree with mine. More to the point, he used to be a test pilot. And I realized test pilots are not the kind of people that you want to creatively interpret their written instructions. So I could see where he was coming from and respect him all the more. Plus, I got to meet Chris and Nicole, which was great fun.
And I think, yeah, you know, Brother Guy, we think about those Bible studies often. And you know, one of the things about it was when Chris and I first came to Houston and to the astronaut office in particular, we were, I think, very pleasantly surprised to find that I think the majority of the office has, you know, is actively involved with their faith in one way or another. And I don't know maybe why we were surprised by that. I think people generally think of these sciencey folks or techie folks as not having religion in any way. And that gentleman that you speak of really brought us back to our kind of faith-based practice. And we don't share a lot of the same ideas that he does either, but we are so thankful to him for that, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of re-revelation in our lives that then I think, you know, opened us up to meeting you as well. Don't you think?
Absolutely. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, thank you for having me and us today. And hello, Brother Guy. It's awesome to see you. I'm very fortunate to be married to Nicole. I met my best friend and married her. At least that part was good in my life. I'm not stupid that way. But, you know, but also spent most of my life working in the satellite and space industry, working in communication satellites, launching things into space. And in the last couple of years, actively looking at putting things in and on the moon.
Which brings us to one of our topics. We're going to be talking about the moon. So, everyone, why is NASA returning to the moon?
Well,
how long have you got?
You know, I mean, seriously, yeah. You know, and I'll just start by saying I am so happy that we can have a conversation that includes NASA having a desire to return to the moon. I think, you know, collectively around the planet, this interest in returning to the moon. And I would like to hope that all of us here on this podcast today are excited about that too, for a number of reasons. You know, I look at it like everything I did as an astronaut in space and that I see having happened and happening in the future with it is ultimately about improving life on Earth. And the moon is our God-given, I'll say, satellite, their, you know, space station, you know, orbiting us is this place that we should be to help benefit life on Earth, as well as the extension for as human beings exploring further out into our solar system, perhaps universe. I'm hopeful that that's part of NASA's rationale as well.
You know, there's a famous line from The Right Stuff, which was describing the Mercury missions 60 years ago now.
Yeah.
And the famous line was, no Bucks, no Buck Rogers. But I think the truth is actually the other way around. If there's no Buck Rogers, there's no Bucks. Why are we putting robots in space? Because the robots are a stand-in for when we get to go to space. And if I just disagree with anything Nicole has said, it's when she says that the role of NASA is to improve life on Earth. And I would just say it's to improve life, period.
Well, I agree with you.
And that life has got to be more than just life on Earth. Every astronaut who has gone to the space station has represented all of humanity. And nothing taught me that more than when I was off in Africa in the Peace Corps. Because, you know, 35 years ago, I'm wondering, why am I doing astronomy when people are starving in the world? And the people in Kenya, many of whom were suffering from a drought, nonetheless were hungry for more than just to fill their stomach. This is something that I run into as a Jesuit. Why would Jesuits be, you know, doing astronomy instead of serving soup in a soup kitchen? You have to remember, what is the goal of helping the poor? It's not to make the poor rich. It's to make the poor rich enough that they can become completely human, that they don't have to worry about food all the time, but that they can do what we're called to do in the seventh day of creation, which is to glorify God by being amazed at what God has created and looking back on it and saying, this is good.
Well, and I think it's wonderful, too. I mean, speaking directly to that, that the vision of hope that man cannot live on bread alone. And there we have our new president, President Biden. And one of the details they've been sharing about his office is he's put the moon rock in the office.
Yeah.
And not just any tiny little piece of moon rock. He's put a piece of a really big chunk of something from 1972 from the last Apollo mission, Apollo 17. It's really astounding. And then when you look at going back to the moon, it is that hope. And the idea being that, you know, you have to look outside yourself. We can't just look at the mundane every day. It's an amazing place for science. It's resources. It's access to energy. It changes the Malthusian equation here on Earth. And Nicole said, a God-given gift to be able to go to space, improve life for all. But he put it there, just there, where we could see it every day. And it's just like, oh, I could see it. Oh, my gosh, I really want to get up there and do something. Oh, yeah. What could I do from there?
And it's close enough that we can actually reach it, unlike Mars.
Yes.
You know, and what a unique thing that we've got a moon tantalizing us, inviting us.
Almost challenging us.
Yeah.
Well, you know, can I throw something out here and I'm just go really deep end stuff on this? All right. So there's been a gap since 1972 of us going back. And I think this year alone, there's 9 countries have missions planned to the moon. It's this amazing turnaround. And it's almost as if we were cast out into the wilderness. I'm just going to say that because what was it? When our Lord showed Moses the promised land and the Israelites were like, he's like, right, you lot, out, gone, for a generation, to be improved. And it's like, oh my gosh, there we were in the Apollo program, like, here's the promised land, here's all these solutions we could have done things with, where we might not have had some of the issues we have today on Earth. We probably still would have had issues, of course, with people. But all of a sudden, that generational shift has happened. There's that new realization of going back. We have these new capabilities, these new tools, these new motivations, and it's the whole world going back this time. It's wonderful.
And we forget what the world was like before we saw Ed Andrews' photograph.
Yep.
Yeah.
How that one picture changed everything so completely that the people who came after it don't even appreciate how much it changed. And it's only those of us who are old enough to remember before and after who can say, yep, going to the moon changed everybody on Earth.
And I think that's one of the most, you know, beautiful things about it is this. It's kind of this thing that's going to...
Bill Anders, not Ed Andrews. I'm sorry. I just realized that. Bill Anders is the astronaut. Ed Andrews was the meteorite astronomer. Sorry. Anyway, I've totally destroyed your train of view.
I knew what you meant. But you know how wonderful it is that whole in-your-face, glorious, who and where we all are in space together thing. You know, the reality that we are all in space, we are on a planet, you know, this idea that we are all Earthlings, thin blue line, the only border that matters, you know, that's protecting us from that deadly vacuum of space, all of us together. And, you know, going back to the moon as that imagery starts to come back to humanity again in a way that's not, it's become so ubiquitous, right? I'm so thankful to Google Earth, right? Because when you open it up and you're looking for your place, it starts with a planet. And yet you have to drill down to find the spot you want. But it's on video screens and our airplanes, you know, tracking our way. And it's just become kind of expected. And I think when we see Earth from the moon again, we are going to see it in a new, unexpected way. And there is going to be this reality check again of who and where we all are in space together. I think that's the awe and wonder of it, right? The kind of thing that we need to encourage people to be looking at in their own backyard. And that comes from looking up, I think, at the moon, but also just from just appreciating what's around you every day in a whole new way.
Well, you mentioned lunar missions in 1972. It amazes me that it's taken this long before we've had another sample returned. 1972. And how many we've had? China just returned some lunar samples. We've got Hayabusa 2 returning asteroid samples, and OSIRIS-REx on the way back now with a lot of asteroid samples. And now we've got our first female vice president. I'm hearing with this Artemis push that there's going to be female astronauts on the moon by 2024. That's great. I can't wait.
Yeah, and our second Catholic president.
Yeah. I'm happy to volunteer for those female footprints on the moon. I think, you know, I don't see that happening, but I am really pleased at the mix of women that they have right now targeted for that role. We'll be very excited to see. I was so hopeful that original announcement was going to be who that person, those people would be, but mm-hmm. We can wait.
Gonna keep them competing though. Yeah. Keep the mystery.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I looked at my Bible study today. I mean, I'm good. I do it every day. First thing I do when I wake up, and I was thinking, okay, what? Some guidance, please, Lord. And Brother Guy, to what you were speaking to, and Bob and Nicole. All right, so today my Bible verse of the day was Matthew 5:14. And you were talking about why America's going back and why, you know, the idea of people look to the future, look to the moon, look to space and science. And as ye are the light of the world, a city set on the hill cannot be hid. And the idea being that, woof, I was just like, oh, wow, okay, yes, Lord.
That'll do it. and you were mentioning about the number of religious believers who you find at NASA. One of my fellow grad students was Carl Allen, who went on to become the curator of extraterrestrial materials. And he was the son of a Presbyterian minister and very active in the Presbyterian church on Webster, where he had me give a talk. In the stained glass of the church is a piece of the Allende meteorite.
Wow.
On display is the chalice that Buzz Aldrin took to the moon for the communion service. As I like to remind my Catholics, it was a Presbyterian communion service, wasn't the real thing. But the other thing he pointed out was that a number of the scientists at the Johnson Space Center who were doing the Is There Life on Mars from the meteorite were also fellow members of that church with him. Or another one who was a Lutheran, very devout Lutheran among that team of scientists. And I think that's important because you need a vision for more than just yourself to want to be able to do something as crazy as spending your life, your one and only life, going to the moon and, you know, trying to even think about living there someday.
Yeah, I love what you just said too, Brother Guy, because before we met you in person, we were able to, you know, read some of your wonderful writings on this intersection between science and religion and how there should be no conflict there. I think about it in so many ways, like, you know, science and art, same thing. You know, people think you can only use half of your brain, right? We should be using our whole brain. And how there just is, I mean, just in the, I'm looking out at my backyard and I'm thinking, how can there be a conflict? How can there be a conflict? And so I love that when we arrived at Johnson Space Center and discovered this, you know, majority of people who are really looking to not only the science of it, but to the faith of it and the understanding of the universe around us that way, kind of in this collective integrated way that I think brings us the best, you know, brings us the best in all of it.
Well, I want to add one more reason why I want to go to the moon, why I want to be one of the people living there, what I'm looking forward to. The reason I got into science was because of science fiction. I went to MIT because it had the world's biggest collection of science fiction books. And I studied planets because planets are places where people can have adventures. And one story that captured my imagination was a short story by Robert A. Heinlein, The Menace from Earth.
Yes.
Which is a delightfully ironic title. It's about a bunch of kids living in a lunar settlement as a bunch of scientists, you know, in a description that sounds very up to date, either one of those underground lava tubes that you could seal off. And he did the math. If you have high enough air pressure and a low enough gravity, you can strap on wings and fly. Mm-hmm. And oh, I want to be able to do that.
I highly recommend it, by the way.
You were able to do it without even strapping on the wings.
Yeah.
Well, it's fun because we were talking about that earlier, just before the call started. And that's, are we at that point in humanity where all of a sudden, you know, people say, does life imitate art or does art imitate life? And they have that fantastic example of science fiction where it can inspire us to do things. And it's almost like they're the tip of the spear, these amazing authors and the men and women who write these incredible books based on fact and engineering and trying to extrapolate. And it gives us that amazing vision of what could be. We're almost there. It's astounding.
There's a lot of things that robots can do and computers can do. But the one thing they don't do is have imagination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the other questions we have here are, what are the advantages of a moon base, and what would a moon settlement look like? Since we're talking about really sending people back to the moon, finally.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting what you guys were just talking about, too, is that, and it's something Chris always says as we're talking about this future life on the moon, it's the future life in the moon. And, you know, and how we're going to take advantage of just the natural, you know, existence there, these lava tubes that provide us with this structure for us to just take advantage of and make our place. And then there will be the things on the moon, and we'll all want to get up there and experience the amazing view too. But I like the way Chris talks about life in the moon.
Gosh, no, it's funny. We've been dedicatedly working on this for a couple of years, and that's something I hope we can be discussing more openly in the future. But so when you're looking at the moon, it's an amazing place. It is Earth's largest satellite. It is like a Rock of Gibraltar in the sky. It's like a space station fully loaded with amazing resources, including water and all sorts of things we need. But living on the surface of the moon, like living on an eggshell in the middle of a blast furnace, right? So the surface of the moon is an amazing. We've seen people, you know, drive lunar rovers. We've seen them play golf. We've done amazing science, jump around. I can't wait, Brother Guy. I'd love to do that too. But being on the actual surface, you're also in this very strong radiation environment. You've got this constant rain of micrometeorites. You've got a day-night cycle. You've got 2 weeks of day and 2 weeks of night. Sounds wonderful, but the 2 weeks of day are at plus 250 degrees Celsius, and the nighttime are at minus 140 degrees Celsius. It's a pretty sporty place to live. So we always thought in the past, oh my gosh, we should really get underground. Again, science fiction has talked about this. Mr. Heinlein wrote about this in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress and The Menace from Earth and others. But the idea is we need to get underground. And then we think, well, how do we do that? Do we take these big tunnel boring machines like for the channel tunnel to the moon? Oh my gosh, how much is that going to cost? How do we do these things? And then something wonderful happened. We knew about this in the late 70s, but it was confirmed again by a series of NASA missions and the Japanese Space Agency Selene mission, radar mission. We found these wonderful lava tubes, as Nicole said. There's over 2,700 of them. So if you listen to this and you want to go out and see them, you can actually almost see them with the naked eye. You look up at the moon and those dark patches of the moon, the mare, the seas, that's where they are. And we don't quite know what caused them because, of course, the causes on Earth, we call them lava tubes because it's basalt. And there are these huge tunnels that look like subway systems. They're huge. One particular one up in the Marius Hills is 93 kilometers long. It's between 40 and 50 meters deep. It's 500 to 1,000 meters wide. And was they caused by the gas and volcanic eruptions or impacts and other things? We don't know. But they're there. And some of them have holes in the roof, wonderfully provided by you-know-who. And so it's just like, oh my goodness, thank you, Lord. They're right there. We don't have to take all these things with us. It's like almost like he's purpose-built the condo for us. We just have to go move in.
Somebody, even with a small telescope, can see evidence of these because where they have collapsed, They show up in the Mare regions as long, thin lines, which are perfectly visible even in a small telescope.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, brother, you hit the nail on the head. People can actually go outside, look up, and then hopefully see in the future where people are living in the moon, sheltered from all of these day-night cycles, the hot, the cold, the radiation, the micrometeorites, in a pretty stable environment with access to all those resources, energy up top, during the daytime and solar power and communications up top, line of sight, communications to the Earth 24/7 a day, 24 hours, 7 days a week. Because, of course, the moon doesn't turn, doesn't spin. We spin. It doesn't.
Relative to us.
Yes. Well, sorry. Yes. The experts. Yes. Quite right. And so the idea being that, it is there. It is almost within our grasp. And you have NASA's talking about going back, of course, with Artemis, and they've got their southern Mount Base Olympus, Olympus Base, which I thought was a wonderful name. You know, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Olympus. I was like, awesome. I was pitching for Valhalla, but I was just like, no, that's my North background. I'm like, nope, behave yourself. And the Chinese are looking to go back with a human settlement within 5 years, according to their recent press releases. Now, they have a sort of a cadence of their missions. But so is Europe. So is India. So is South Korea. I mean, it's amazing what's happening. It's like a renaissance going back using all this exponential technology.
And again, one of the things, being a gray hair here and being old enough to remember, that people forget is, of course, the original missions to the moon came out of the Cold War. They also were products of World War II. And one of the effects of World War II was that most engineering and science and the wealth needed to go to the moon had been wiped out of Europe, and it took a generation. There were great European scientists. One of my thesis advisors was a European scientist, but he was in Arizona because there was no money in Europe to be able to do that work in the 60s and the 50s. That's changed. China was certainly not the powerhouse it is today. That's changed. India is a country with a phenomenal space program. From the outside, you think of, a billion poor people in India. You forget that India has an economy that matches the United States with the number of middle-class people that matches the United States, because it's a really big place. And they're very bright and very capable and have already built space missions. This can only work, first of all, if we all figure out how to cooperate with each other. And that's one of the things that the Vatican is allowing people to do, because the Vatican and the Vatican Observatory has been a neutral site where all of the different spacefaring nations can meet together. And Chris, you were part of that a couple of years ago, and we had a workshop at the Vatican Observatory on that. Because at the end of the day, we need a set of rules that everybody's agreed to follow. One of the things, we've learned in politics around the world, not just in America in the last few years, is that laws and rules only work when everybody is bought into them. And it's like, we're all going to agree that red means stop and green means go. Not necessarily because red is better than green, but because we all have to agree that rules are needed, and this is how we're going to do it, because it makes things better for everybody. We need to get back to that spirit so that we can use the moon, and whether it's a place to mine data or mine minerals, use it in a way that the people who have invested in the mining can get their, just rewards for it, without it being stolen from somebody else, without living in fear of another nation, but rather recognizing with all of us working together, we can do great things. And if all of us are, busy worrying about the other guy, it gets in the way.
As you're talking, I know we're focusing on the moon, but it just makes me think about the International Space Station as this wonderful example of how that has peacefully and successfully happened, right? For over 20 years now, people from 15 different countries, have come together. They decided what this, greater mission was, what the rules of engagement would be, and how they would make this happen, and have been doing that on the space station, circling the planet every 90 minutes, with a crew of six, I should say now seven, representing those 15 different countries as one crew. It's not like, the Russians are only down in the Russian segment and, the Japanese guys can only go into the GEM module. This is one station with one crew, one commander, working in the very way you just described. I don't know. It's the way we should be living and working here on Spaceship Earth as well. But it also gives us this wonderful guide for how we can go as perhaps even more countries, representing this planet to do the same thing on the lunar surface or inside of the moon as well.
25 years ago, I had the chance to be part of an expedition to Antarctica. And again, international rules have been put in place that we all agreed to. And though there we do have an American section and a New Zealand section, there is also the sense that it's precarious for everybody. And if we need help from one to another, it's given without question.
Well, that's, you know, what you just said is like, that's what it comes down to, right? Is the survival. It's survival in the end, right? And, you know, we build this space station in space as this mechanical system that mimics as best we can what Earth does for us naturally. We're going to have to do those same things on and in the moon when we go there. And in the end, it's like when something happens on the space station, you know, us US astronauts, we're not thinking, oh man, I hope that's on the Russian segment because I don't want us to die down here. It is absolutely about the survival of every single crew member. And you're not leaving any, you know, it's the same thing. You're not leaving any crew member behind. And we've shown it. It's that here's how we can. You've met, I believe, Jay Honeycutt before, one of my and Chris's, you know, mentors for life. And when I started at Kennedy Space Center as a young engineer on the shuttle program, he shared this motto of here's how we can, not why we can't. And that has stuck with me throughout everything. And when I look at how we went to the moon, how we're going to go back again, how we do these things on the space station, it's with that underlying belief that there is a solution to every challenging problem. And going in together with that, I don't know, it just makes really incredible things happen.
Yeah, if you'd asked, again, you said go back 25 years ago, and if you'd asked me to, you know, before the end of the Cold War, that I ever think my son, our son, that our son would have two godfathers, one American and one Russian, I was like, oh, please, no way. You know, I there's no way. I thought I was going to die in a ditch somewhere covered in radiation burns shooting at Russians. I had no idea we'd make it to 2021. I'm like, wow. And then you look at something like that and you think, oh my gosh. And then when you were getting to meet the first Russians in Houston and we were talking, and then you found not just this common interest in space and doing the right thing for the whole human race, you also found this common link in faith. And it was the most wonderful thing. And I never thought ever in my life I'd ever talk to a former citizen of the Soviet Union, now a Russian citizen. And we would be talking there about their view of cosmology and faith and the role that faith played in their lives as cosmonauts and their fellow scientists and their appreciation of our Lord in the universe. I was like, wow, I thought you were all communists. I didn't know that was allowed. I had no idea. But it was amazing how faith could be a bridge, even in the high technology areas. You know, it was wonderful.
Okay, one of the other questions I have here is when can we expect moon tourism to start?
SpaceX have already apparently booked someone for a cislunar mission on one of the starships, a Japanese gentleman, I believe.
With art in mind.
Yeah, and they've said that's, what, 2023? And everyone was scoffing at it, but it's amazing the progress they're making on Starship. They were talking about, Mr. Musk very kindly tweeted this just before Christmas, so Kat is firmly out of the bag on this one, that they're planning to try for 2022 for the next Mars conjunction for their first Starship. Not with people, you know, uncrewed, no one in it.
Kat, you know, you think about it, how about, I don't know a date, but I believe it's in my lifetime. You know, I think that's an interesting thing to consider is, you know, the same way I think about my son who's 18 and how not a day has gone by in his life where there hasn't been this continuous human presence in space. I believe that even as the old person that I am, in my lifetime, we will see not only those new footsteps on the moon, but we'll see people that are traveling there as spaceflight participants, aka tourists.
Yeah, I'd go in a heartbeat.
I know.
It's the only way I probably could go. Would be sending me for my academic prowess. So I would, yeah, but Brother Guy, I would definitely go and I would strap on wings and in a moment of joy, go flying with you.
Yes.
Okay, that's it for this podcast. I'd like to thank our guests, Nicole Stott, Chris Stott, and Brother Guy Consolmagno. You can follow Nicole on Facebook at Nicole Stott, the Artistic Astronaut, and on her websites, NicoleStott.com and SpaceForArtFoundation.org. Chris's websites are Mansat, that's MANSAT.com, Space Isle, that's SpaceISLE.com, and ICESAT.IS. You can listen to other podcasts at the Vatican Observatory website. And clear skies, everyone.
Thank you very much. Thanks, you guys.